at his thrashing body. "I'm Prime," I say, tearing my eyes from my old friend as blood pools beneath him and he fights for his life. "Help Ragnar." Over Cassius's body, we see the Stained and Aja whirling at each other on the edge of a crevasse. Blood paints the snow around them, all of it coming from Ragnar. But still he presses the woman knight back, a furious song cascading out of his throat, beating her down, overwhelming her with his 250 kilograms of mass. Sparks flare from their blades. She caves before him now, unable to match the anger of the banished prince of the spires. Heels skidding on the snow, arms shuddering, bending back away from Ragnar, bending like a willow. His song roars louder.
"No," I murmur.
"Shoot her," I tell Mustang. "They're too close. I don't care." She fires a shot. It rips inches past Aja's head. But it does not matter. Ragnar has already fallen into the trap the woman has laid for him. Mustang doesn't see it yet. She will. It's one of the many Lorne taught me. The one Ragnar could not have learned, because he never had a razor master.
He only ever had his rage, and years of fighting with solid weapons, not the whip.
Mustang loads another arrow, and Ragnar swings down at Aja with a blacksmith's overhead strike. Aja raises her rigid blade to meet his. She activates the whip function. Her blade goes limp, expecting to meet the resistance of solid polyene fiber. Ragnar's whole weight carries down on empty air. He's athletic enough to slow the movement so his blade doesn't smash into the ground, and against a lesser opponent he would have recovered with ease. But Aja was the greatest student of Lorne Ao Arcos. She's already spinning to the side, contracting the whip back into a blade and using her momentum to hack sideways at Ragnar as she finishes her spin. The movement is simple, laconic. Like one of the ballerinas Mustang and Roke would watch at Aegea's opera house, as I studied with Lorne, pivoting through a fouetté. If I didn't see the blood paint her blade and spray a delicate arc of red across the snow, I could be convinced that she missed. Aja does not miss. Ragnar tries to turn and face her, but his legs betray him, crumpling underneath. His gaping wound a bloody smile against the white of his sealskin. Aja cut into his lower back, through his spinal cord, and out the front of his stomach at the belly button. He flops down at the lip of a crevasse, razor skipping across the ice. I howl in rage, in crushing disbelief, and charge Aja as Mustang fires her bow, running with me. Aja sidesteps Mustang's arrows and stabs Ragnar twice more in the stomach as he lies grasping his wound. His body jerks. The blade slides in and out. Aja sets her feet now, preparing for me, when her eyes go wide. She steps back, marveling at something in the sky above my head. Mustang fires twice in quick succession. Aja's head jerks. She twists away from us, spinning backward to the edge of the crevasse. Ice caves beneath her foot, crumbling off into the crevasse. Her arms windmill, but she can't regain her balance as her eyes meet mine, and she pitches with the ice, head first into the darkness. Chapter 30. The Quiet. Aja is gone. The crevasse deep, sides narrowing away into darkness. I rush back to Ragnar as Mustang stares up at the hillside on the clouds, bow at the ready. She only has 3 arrows left. "I don't see anything," she says.
"Reaper,"
Ragnar murmurs from the ground. His chest heaves, panting heavily. Dark lifeblood pulses out of his open stomach. Azure could have finished him quickly, with 2 thrusts, when he was on the ground. Instead, she stabbed his lower gut so he would suffer as he died. I push on the first wound, red to my elbows, but there's so much blood I don't even know what to do. A res gun can't fix what Azure has done. It can't even hold him together. The tears sting my eyes. Can hardly see. Steam billows from the wound. My frozen fingers tingling with warmth from the blood. Ragnar blanches at the blood, an embarrassed look on his face as he whispers apologies. "It could be the cannibals," Mustang says, regarding Azure's distraction. "Can he move?" "No," I say weakly. She glances down at him, more stoic than I am. "We can't stay here," she says. I ignore her. I've watched too many friends die to let Ragnar go. I led him to fight Azure. I convinced him to come home. I will not let him slip away. I owe him that much. If it is the last thing I do, foolish or not, I will defend him. I will find some way to fix him, get him to a yellow, even if the cannibals come. Even if it costs me my life, I will not leave him. But thinking it doesn't make it true, doesn't give me magical powers. Whatever plan I make, it seems the world is content to undo it.
"Reaper,"
Ragnar manages again. "Save your strength, my friend. It's going to take all of it to get you out of here."
"She was fast. So fast."
"She's gone now," I say, though I can't know for sure.
"I always dreamed of a good death."
He shudders as he realizes again that he's dying.
"This does not seem good."
His words fishhook a sob from my chest into my throat. "It's fine," I say thickly. "It'll be fine. Once we get you patched up, Mickey will fix you proper. We'll get you to the spires. Call in an evac."
"Darrow,"
Mustang says. Ragnar blinks hard up at me, trying to focus his eyes. He reaches for the sky with a hand.
"Serfi."
"No, it's me, Ragnar. It's Darrow," I say. "Darrow," Mustang presses sharply. "What?" I snap.
"Serfi."
Ragnar points. I follow his finger to the sky above. I see nothing, just the faint clouds shifting in the wind that comes in from the sea. I hear only the sound of Cassius's hacking and the creak of Mustang's bow, and Holiday limping toward us over the snow. Then I see why Azure fled, as 3,000 kilograms of winged predator pierces the clouds. Body that of a lion, wings, front legs, and head that of an eagle. Feathers white, beak hooked and black, head the size of a grown red. The griffin is huge, underside of its wings painted with the screaming faces of sky-blue demons. They stretch 10 meters wide as the beast lands in the snow in front of me. The earth shakes. Its eyes are pale blue, glyphs and wards painted along its black beak in white. Upon its back sits a lean, terrible human, who blows mournfully on a white horn. More horns echo from the clouds above, and 12 more griffins slam down into the mountain pass, some clinging to the sharp rock walls above us, others pawing at the snow. The first griffin rider, the one who blew the horn, is cloaked head to toe in filthy white fur, and wears a bone helmet crested with a single spine of blue feathers, which trail down the back of the neck. Not a rider is under 2 meters tall. Sunborn, one of them calls in their sluggish dialect as she rushes to the side of their silent leader. The speaker strips her helmet to reveal a brutish face, thick with scars and piercings, before falling to her knee and touching her forehead with a gloved palm in a sign of respect. A blue handprint covers her face.
We saw the flame in the sky.
Her voice falters when she sees my sling blade. The other riders strip their helms, dismounting in a rush as they see our hair and eyes. Not a rider among them is a man. The women's faces are painted with huge sky-blue handprints, a little eye drawn in the center of each. White hair flows in long braids down their backs. Black eyes peer from hooded lids. Iron and bone piercings, bridge noses, and hook lips and notch ears. Only the lead rider has yet to remove her helmet, or kneel. She steps toward us in a trance.
Sister, Ragnar manages. My sister.
Sefi,
Mustang repeats, eyeing the black human tongues on the prize hook on the obsidian's left hip. She wears no gloves. The backs of her hands are tattooed with glyphs.
Do you know me?
Ragnar rasps, a tentative smile on quivering lips as the rider approaches.
You must.
The rider catalogues his scars from behind her mask, eyes dark and wide.
I know you,
Ragnar continues.
I would know you if the world were dark and we were withered and old.
He shudders in pain.
If the ice was melted and the wind quiet.
She drifts forward, step by step.
I taught you the 49 names of the ice, the 34 breaths of the wind.
He smiles.
Though you could only ever remember 32.
She gives him nothing, but the other riders are already whispering his name and looking at us as if by accompanying him and possessing a curved blade, they've pieced together who I am. Ragnar continues, voice carrying the last of his strength.
I carried you on my shoulders to watch 5 breakings, and let you braid my hair with your ribbons, and played with the dolls you made from seal leather, and threw balls of ice at old Proudfoot. I am your brother. And when the men of the Weeping Sun took me and a harvest of our kin to the Chained Lands, do you remember what I told you?
Despite his wound, the man reeks of power. This is his land. This is his home. And he is as vast here as I was upon my claw drill. The gravity of him draws Sefi closer. She collapses to her knees and strips away her bone helmet. Sefi the Quiet, famed daughter of Alia Snowsparrow, is raw and majestic, face severe, angled like a crow's. Her eyes too small, too close together. Her lips thin, purple in the cold, and permanently pursed in thought. White hair shaved down the left side, braided and falling to the waist on the right. A wing tattoo, encircled by astral runes, is livid blue the left side of her pale skull. But what makes her unique among the Obsidians, and the object of their admiration, is that her skin is without pox or scars. The only ornament she wears is a single iron bar through her nose. And when she blinks down at Ragnar's wound, the blue eyes tattooed on the back of her eyelids pierce through me.
She extends a hand to her brother, not to touch him, but to feel the breath steam before his mouth and nose. It is not enough for Ragnar. He seizes her hand and presses it fiercely to his chest so she can feel his fading heartbeat. Tears of joy gather in his eyes, and when they spill from Sefi's, down her cheeks, to carve paths through her blue war paint, his voice cracks.
I told you I would return.
Her eyes leave him, to follow Azure's tracks into the crevasse. She clicks her tongue, and four Valkyries stake ropes into the snow and rappel down into the darkness to seek out Azure. The rest guard their war leader and watch the hills. Elegant recurve bows at the ready. We have to fly him to the spires, I say in their language. To your shaman. Sefi does not look at me.
It is too late.
Snow gathers on Ragnar's white beard.
Let me die here. On the ice. Under the wild sky.
No, I mumble. We can save you. The world feels very distant and unimportant. His blood continues to leave him, but there is no more sadness in my friend. Sefi has chased it away.
It is no great thing to die,
he says to me, though I know he doesn't mean it as deeply as he wants to.
Not when one has lived.
He smiles, trying to comfort me even now. But he wears the unjustness of his life and death upon his face.
I owe that to you. But there is much undone. Sefi.
He swallows, his tongue heavy and dry.
Did my men find you?
Sefi nods, staying hunched over her brother, her white hair flying about her in the wind. He looks to me.
Darrow, I know you think words will suffice.
Ragnar says in Oriat lingo, so Sefi cannot understand.
They will not. Not with my mother.
This was what he did not tell me. Why he was so quiet on the shuttle, why he carried dread upon his shoulders. He was coming home to kill his mother. And now he's giving me permission to do just that. I glance over to Mustang. She heard, too, and wears her heartbreak on her face. As much for my shattered fool's dream of a better world as for my dying friend. He shudders in pain, and Sefi pulls a knife from her boot, unwilling to watch him suffer any longer. Ragnar shakes his head at her and nods to me. He wants me to do it. I shake my head, as if I can wake up from this nightmare. Sefi stares at me fiercely, daring me to contradict her brother's last wishes.
I will die with my friends,
Ragnar says. I numbly let my razor slither into my hand and hold it over his chest. There's peace at last in Ragnar's wet eyes. It's all I can do to be strong for him.
I will give Io your love. I will make a house for you in the Vale of your fathers. It will be beside my own. Join me there when you die.
He grins.
But I am no builder, so take your time. We will wait. I nod, like I still believe in the veil, like I still think it waits for me, and for him. Your people will be free, I say. On my life I promise this, and I will see you soon. He smiles as he stares up at the sky. Sefi frantically puts her axe in Ragnar's palm so that he can die as a warrior, a weapon in hand, and secure his place in the halls of Valhalla. No, Sefi, he says, dropping the axe and taking Snow in his left hand, her hand with his right. Live for more. He nods to me. The wind whips. The snow falls. Ragnar watches the sky, where the cold lights of Phobos glitter on as I silently slide the metal into his heart. Death comes like nightfall, and I cannot tell the moment when the light leaves him, when his heart no longer beats and his eyes no longer see. But I know he's gone. I feel it in the chill that settles over me, and the sound of the lonely, hungry wind, and the dread silence in the black eyes of Sefi the Quiet. My friend, my protector, Ragnar Valaris has left this world. Chapter 31 The Pale Queen. I am numb with grief, unable to think of anything but how Sevra will react when he hears Ragnar has died, how my nieces and nephews will never braid another bow into the friendly giant's hair. Part of my soul has departed, and will never return. He was my protector. He gave so many strength. Now, without him, I cling to the back of a Valkyrie as her griffin rises away from the bloody snow. Even as we soar through the clouds on great beating wings, even as I see the Valkyrie spires for the first time, I feel no awe, just numbness. The spires are a twisting, vertiginous spine of mountain peaks, so ludicrous in their abrupt rise from the Arctic plains, that only a maniacal gold at the controls of a Lovelock engine, with 50 years of tectonic manipulation and a solar system of resources, could conspire to create them. Probably just to see if they could. Dozens of stone spires weave together like spiteful lovers. Mist shrouding them, griffins making nests on their peaks, crows and eagles in the lower reaches. Upon a high rock wall, 7 skeletons hang from chains. The ice is stained with blood and the droppings of animals. This is the home of the only race to ever threaten gold. And we come stained in the blood of its banished prince. Sefi and her riders searched the crevasse in which Aja fell. They found nothing but boot prints. No body, no blood. Nothing to abate the rage that burns inside Sefi. I think she would have remained over her brother's body for hours more had they not heard drums beating in the distance. Eaters who had mustered greater strength and intended to challenge the Valkyrie for possession of the fallen gods. Wrath stained her face as she stood over Cassius, her axe in hand. He is one of the first golds she'll ever have seen without armor. Maybe the first aside from Mustang. And I think, stained with the blood of her brother, she would have killed him there on the snow. I know I would have let her, and so too would have Mustang. But she relented at the urging of her Valkyrie, clicking her tongue to her riders, sheathing her axe, and signalling them to mount. Now Cassius is tied to the saddle of a Valkyrie to my right. The arrow missed his jugular, but death might come from even without a kiss from Sefi's axe. We land in a high alcove,
cut into the highest reach of a corkscrew spire. Slaves from enemy obsidian clans, eyes branded into blindness, receive our griffins, their faces painted yellow for cowardice. Iron doors groan shut behind, sealing us off from the wind. The riders jump from their saddles before we can land to help carry Ragnar away from us, deeper into the rock city. There's a commotion as several dozen armed warriors push their way into the griffin stable and confront Sephi. They gesture wildly at us, their accents thicker than the Nagal I learned with Mickey's uploads and my studies at the academy. But I understand enough to glean that the newer group of warriors is shouting that we should be in chains, and something about heretics. Sephi's women are shouting back, saying we are friends of Ragnar, and they point feverishly to the gold of our hair. They don't know how to treat us, or Cassius, who several of the warriors pull away from us like dogs fighting for scrap meat. The arrow is still in his neck, whites of his eyes huge. He reaches for me in terror as the obsidians drag him across the floor. His hand grasps mine, holds for a moment, and then he's gone down a torch-lit hall, borne away by half a dozen giants. The rest cluster around us, huge iron weapons in hand, the stink of their furs thick and nauseating, quieting only when an old, stout woman with a hand-shaped tattoo on her forehead pushes through their ranks to speak with Sephi, one of her mother's war chiefs. She gestures upward towards the ceiling with large hand motions.
"What is she saying?"
Holiday asks.
"They are talking about Phobos. They see the lights from the battle. They think the gods are fighting. These ones think we should be prisoners, not guests,"
Mustang says.
"Let them take your weapons."
"Like hell." Holiday steps back with her rifle. I grab the barrel and push it down, handing them my razor.
"This is bloody spectacular," she mutters.
They shackle our arms and legs with great iron manacles, taking care not to touch our skin or hair, and jerk us toward a tunnel by the spire's guards, away from Sephi's Valkyrie. But as we go, I catch sight of Sephi watching after us, a strange, conflicted look on her white face. After being dragged down several dozen dimly lit stairwells, we're shoved into a windowless cell of carved stone and stifling smoky air. Seal oil smoulders in iron braziers, stinging our eyes. I trip on a raised flagstone and fall to the floor. There, I slam my chains against the stone, feeling the anger, the helplessness, all the things happening so fast, whipping around me, so I can't tell which way's up. But I can think long enough to grasp the futility of my actions, my plans. Mustang and Holiday watch me in heavy silence. One day into my grand plan, and Ragnar is already dead. Mustang speaks more softly.
"Are you all right?"
"What do you think?" I ask bitterly. She says nothing in reply, not the fragile sort of person to take offense and whimper out how she's just trying to help. She knows the pain of loss well enough. "We need to have a plan," I say mechanically, trying to force Ragnar out of my mind.
"Ragnar was our plan," Holiday says. "He was the entire sodding plan."
"We can salvage it."
"And how the hell do you expect to do that?" Holiday asks. "We don't have weapons anymore, and they don't exactly look tickled pink to see us. They're probably going to eat us."
"These ones aren't cannibals," Mustang says.
"You're willing to bet your leg on that, Missy?"
"Alia is the key," I say. "We can still convince her. It would be difficult without Ragnar, but that's the only way. Convince her that he died trying to bring their people the truth."
"Didn't you hear him? He said words wouldn't work."
"They still can."
"Darrow, give yourself a moment," Mustang says.
"A moment? My people are dying in orbit. Severo is at war, and he's depending on us to bring him an army. We don't have the luxury of taking a bloody damn moment.
Darrow... Mustang tries to interrupt. I keep going, methodically sorting through the options, how we must hunt down Azure, rejoin with the Suns. She puts a hand on my arm.
Darrow, stop.
I falter, losing track of where I was, slipping away from the comfort of logic and falling straight into the emotion of it all. Ragnar's blood is under my nails. All he wanted was to come home to his people and lead them out of darkness, like he saw me doing with mine. I robbed him of that choice by leading the attack on Azure. I don't cry. There isn't time for it, but I sit there with my head in my hands. Mustang touches my shoulder.
He smiled in the end, she says softly. Do you know why? Because he knew what he was doing was right. He was fighting for love. You've made a family of your friends. You always have. It made Ragnar a better man to know you. So you didn't get him killed. You helped him live. But you have to live now.
She sits next to me.
I know you want to believe the best in people, but think how long it took for you to get through to Ragnar. To win over Tactus, or me. What can you do in a day? A week? This place... It's not our world. They don't care about our rules or our morality. We will die here if we do not escape.
You don't think Alia will listen?
Why would she? Obsidians only value strength. And where is ours?
Ragnar even thought he would have to kill his mother.
She won't listen. Do you know the word for surrender in Nagal? Ryoga.
The word for subjugation?
Ryoga.
What's the word for slavery?
Ryoga.
Without Ragnar to lead them, what do you think is going to happen if you release them on the society?
Alia Snowsparrow is a black-blooded tyrant, and the rest of the war chiefs are no better.
She might even be expecting us. Even if we've hacked the Gold's monitoring systems, the Gold's know she's his mother, then they could have told her to expect him. She could be reporting to them right now. When I looked up at my father as a boy, I thought being a man was having control, being the master and commander of your own destiny. How could any boy know that freedom is lost the moment you become a man? Things start to count, to press in, constricting slowly, inevitably, creating a cage of inconveniences and duties and deadlines and failed plans and lost friends. I'm tired of people doubting, of people choosing to believe they know what is possible because of what has happened before. Holiday grunts. Escaping won't be that easy.
Step one, Mustang says, as she slips free of her manacles.
She used a little shard of bone to pick the lock.
Where'd you learn that?
Holiday asks.
You think the Institute was my first school?
She asks.
Your turn.
She reaches for my manacles.
As I see it, we can rush them when they open the...
What's wrong?
I've pulled my hands back from her. I'm not leaving.
Darrow. Ragnar was my friend. I told him I would help his people. I will not run to save myself. I will not let him die in vain. The only way out is through.
The Obsidians
are needed, I say. Without them I can't fight Gold's legions. Not even with your help.
All right, Mustang says. Not belaboring the point.
Then how do you intend to change Alia's mind?
I think I need your help with that. Hours later, we are guided to the center of a cavernous throne room built for giants. It's lit by seal oil lamps that belch out black smoke along the walls. The iron doors slam shut behind us, and we're left alone before a throne, upon which sits the largest human being I've ever seen. She watches us from the far side of the room, more statue than woman. We approach awkwardly in our chains. Boots over the slick black floor till we come before Alia Snow Sparrow, Queen of the Valkyrie. Across her lap lies the body of her dead son. Alia glares down at us. She is as colossal as Ragnar, but ancient and wicked, like the oldest tree of some primeval forest. The kind that drinks the soil and blocks the sun for lesser trees, and watches them wither and yellow and die, and does nothing but reach her branches higher and dig her roots deeper. The wind has armored her face in dead skin and calluses. Her hair is stringy and long, the color of dirty snow. She sits on a cushion of furs stacked inside the ribcage of the skeleton of what must have been the largest griffin ever carved. The griffin's head screams silently down at us from above her. The wings spread against the stone wall 10 meters across. On her head is a crown of black glass. At her feet is her fabled war chest, which is locked in times of peace by a great iron device. Her knotty hands are covered in blood. This is the primal realm, and though I would know what to say to a queen who sits upon a throne, I have no bloody damn clue what to say to a mother who sits with her own dead son in her lap and looks at me as though I am some worm that's just slithered up from the tiger. It seems she doesn't much care that I've lost my tongue. Hers is sharp enough.
There is a great heresy in our lands, against the gods who rule the thousand stars of the abyss.
Her voice rumbles like that of an old crocodile. But it is not her language. It is ours. Hylingo Oriat. A sacred tongue known by few in these lands, mostly the shaman who commune with the gods. Spies, in other words. Alia's fluency startles Mustang, but not me. I know how the low rise under the power of the mighty, and this merely confirms what I have long suspected. Slag and Gamma are not the only favored slaves of the worlds.
A heresy told by wicked prophets with wicked aims. For a summer and a winter it has slithered through us, poisoning my people and the people of the dragon spine and the blooded tents and the rattling caves, poisoning them with lies that spit in the eye of our people.
She leans down from her throne. Blackheads huge on her nose, wrinkles deep ravines around pitch eyes.
Lies that say a stained sun will return, and he will bring a man to guide us from this land. A morning star in the darkness. I have sought these heretics out to learn of their whispers, to see if the god spoke through them. They did not. Evil spoke through them. And so I have hunted the heretics, broken their bones with my own hands, peeled their flesh and set them upon the rock of the spires to be eaten as carrion by the fowl of the ice.
The 7 bodies who dangled from the chains outside. Ragnar's friends.
This I do for my people, because I love my people, Because the children of my loins are few, and those of my heart many. For I knew the heresy to be a lie. Ragnar, blood of my blood, would never return. To return would mean the breaking of oaths to me, to his people, to the gods who watch over us from Asgard on high.
She looks down at her dead son.
And then I woke into this nightmare.
She closes her eyes, breathes deep, and opens them again.
Who are you to bring the corpse of my best-born to my spire?
My name is Darrow of Lycos, I say. This is Virginia Au Augustus and Holiday T. Nakamura. Alia's eyes ignore Holiday and twitch over to Mustang. Even at nearly 2 meters, she seems a child in this huge room. We came with Ragnar as a diplomatic mission on behalf of the Rising.
The Rising.
She dislikes the taste of the foreign word.
And who are you to my son?
She eyes my hair with more disdain than a mortal should have for a god. Something deeper is at play here.
Are you Ragnar's master?
I am his brother, I correct.
His brother?
She mocks the idea. Your son swore an oath of servitude to me when I took him from a gold. He offered me stains, and I offered him his freedom. Since then, he has been my brother.
He...
Her voice catches.
Died free?
The way she says it intones that deeper understanding. One Mustang notes.
He did.
His men, the ones you have hanged on the walls outside, would have told you that I led a rebellion against the Golds who rule over you, who took Ragnar from you, as they took your other children. And they would have told you, as well as all your people, that Ragnar was the greatest of my generals. He was a good man. He was...
I know my son,
she interrupts.
I swam with him in the ice floes when he was a boy, taught him the names of the snow, of the storms, and took upon my griffin to show him the spine of the world. His hands clutched my hair and sang for joy as we rose through the clouds above. My son was without fear.
She remembers that day very differently than Ragnar did.
I know my son, and I do not need a stranger to tell me of his spirit.
Then you should ask yourself, Queen, what would make him return here? Mustang says. What would make him send his men here, if he would come here himself, if he knew it meant breaking his oath to you and your people? Alia does not speak as she examines Mustang with those hungry eyes.
Brother.
She mocks the word again, looking back to me.
I wonder, would you use brothers as you have used my son? Bringing him here, as if he is the key to unlocking the giants of the ice?
She looks around the hall so I see the deeds carved into the stone that stretches the height of 15 men above us. I've never met an obsidian artisan. They send us only their warriors.
As if you could use a mother's love against her. This is the way of men. I can smell your ambition. Your plans. I do not know the abyss, O worldly warlord, but I know the ice. I know the serpents that slither in the hearts of men. I questioned the heretics myself. I know what you are. I know you descend from a lower creature than us. A red? I have seen reds. They are like children. Little elves who live in the bones of the world. But you stole the body of an Aesir. Of a sunborn. You call yourself a breaker of chains, but you are a maker of them. You wish to bind us to you, using our strength to make you great. Like every man.
She leans over my dead friend to leer at me, and I see what this woman respects. Why Ragnar believed he would have to kill her and take her throne, and why Mustang wanted to flee.
Strength.
And where is mine, she wonders. You know many things of him, Mustang says, but you know nothing of me, yet you insult me. Alia frowns. It's clear she has no idea who Mustang is, and no wish to anger a true gold, if, indeed, Mustang is one. Her confidence wavers only a fraction.
I have laid no claims against you, Sunborn.
But you have. By suggesting he has evil wishes in store for your people, you two suggest that I collude with him. That I, his companion, I'm here with the same wicked intentions.
Then what are your intentions? Why do you accompany this creature?
To see if he was worth following, Mustang says.
And is he?
I don't know yet. What I do know is that millions will follow him. Do you know that number? Can you even comprehend it, Alia?
I know the number.
You asked my intentions, Mustang says. I will put it plainly. I am a warlord and queen like you. My dominion is larger than you can comprehend. I have metal ships in the abyss that carry more men than you have ever seen, that can crack the highest mountain in two. And I am here to tell you that I am not a god. Those men and women on Asgard are not gods. They are flesh and blood. Like you. Like me. Alia rises slowly, bearing her huge son easily in her arms, and walks him to a stone altar and lays him upon it. She pours oil from a small urn onto a cloth and drapes it over Ragnar's face. Then she kisses the cloth, looking down at him. Mustang presses her. This land cannot hold seed. It is ruled by wind and ice and barren rock. But you survive. Cannibals roam the hills. Enemy clans ache for your land. But you survive. You sell your sons, your daughters to your gods. But you survive. Tell me, Alia, why? Why live when all you live for is to serve? To watch your family wither away? I've watched mine go. Each stolen from me, one by one. My world is broken. And so is yours. But if you join your arms with mine, with Darrow, as Ragnar wanted, we can make a new world. Alia turns back to us, beleaguered. Her steps are slow and measured as she comes before us.
Which would you fear more, Virginia Augustus? A god or a mortal with the power of a god?
The question hangs between them, creating a rift words cannot mend.
A god cannot die, so a god has no fear. But mortal men...
She clucks her tongue behind her stained teeth.
How frightened they are that the darkness will come. How horribly they will fight to stay in the light.
A corrupt voice chills my blood.
She knows.
Mustang and I realize it at the same terrible moment. Alia knows her gods are mortal. A new fear bubbles up from the deepest part of me. I'm a fool. We traveled all this distance to pull the wool from her eyes, but she's already seen the truth.
Somehow. Some way.
Did the golds come to her because she is queen?
Did she discover it herself?
Before she sold Ragnar?
After?
It's no matter. She's already resigned herself to this world, to the lie.
There's another path.
I say desperately, knowing that Alia made her judgment against us before we ever entered the room.
Ragnar saw it. He saw a world where your people could leave the ice, where they could make their own destiny.
Join me, and that world is possible. I will give you the means to take the power that will let you cross the stars like your ancestors, to walk unseen, to fly among the clouds on boots. You can live in the land of your choosing, where the wind is warm as flesh and the land is green instead of white. All you need to do is fight with me, like your son did.
No, little man. You cannot fight the sky. You cannot fight the river or the sea or the mountains. And you cannot fight the gods.
Alia says,
So I will do my duty. I will protect my people. I will send you to Asgard in chains. I will let the gods on high decide your fate. My people will live on. Sethi will inherit my throne, and I will bury my son in the ice from which he was born.
Chapter 32. No Man's Land. The sky is the color of blood underneath a dead nail as we fly away from the spires. This time we are imprisoned, chained belly down to the back of fetid fur saddles like luggage. My eyes water as the wind of the lower troposphere slashes into them. The griffin beats its wings, muscled shoulders rippling, churning the air. We bank sideways, and I see the riders tilting their masked faces up to the sky to see the faint light that is Phobos. Little flashes of white and yellow mar the darkening sky as ships overhead battle. I pray silently for Sevro's safety, for Victra's and the Howlers. Words failed with Alia, as Mustang said they would. And now we are bound for Asgard, a gift for the gods to secure the future of her people. That is what she told Sethi. And her silent daughter took my chains and, with the help of Alia's personal guards, dragged me and Mustang and Holiday to the hangar where her Valkyrie waited. Now, hours later, we pass over a land created by wrathful gods in their youth. Dramatic and brutal, the Antarctic was designed as punishment and a test for the ancestors of the Obsidians who dared rise against the Golds in the 200th year of their reign. A place so savage, less than 60% of Obsidians reach adulthood, per Board of Quality quotas. That desperate struggle for life robs them of a chance for culture and societal progress, just as the nomadic tribes of the first Dark Ages were so robbed. Farmers make culture. Nomads make war. Subtle signs of life freckle the bald waste. Roving herds of auroch. Fires on mountain ridges, glittering from the cracks and the great doors of obsidian cities that are carved into the rock, as they gather supplies and huddle behind their walls on the eve of the long dark of winter. We fly for hours. I fall in and out of sleep, body exhausted. Not having closed my eyes since we shared the pasta with Ragnar in our cozy hole in the belly of that dead ship. How has so much changed so quickly? I wake to the bellow of a horn. Ragnar is dead. It's the first thought in my head. I am no stranger waking to grief. Another horn echoes as Sephi's riders close their gaps, drifting together into tight formation. We rise amidst a sea of ash-gray clouds. Sephi bent over the reins in front of me, pushing her griffin hard toward a hulking darkness. We slip free of the clouds to find Asgard hanging in the twilight. It's a black mountain, ripped from the ground by the gods, and hung halfway between the abyss and the ice world below. Seat of the Aesir. Where Olympus was a bright celebration of the senses, this is a brooding threat to a conquered race. A set of stone stairs, precarious and seemingly unsupported, rises from the mountains, tethering Asgard to the world below. The Way of Stains. The path all young obsidian must take if they wish to gain the favor of the gods, to bring honor and bounty to their tribes by becoming the servants of All-Mother Death. Bodies litter the valley of the fallen beneath. Frozen mounds of men and women in a land where carrion never rots, and only the industry of crows can make proper skeletons. It is a lonely walk, and one we must make if the obsidian are to approach the mountain. This is what it takes to make an obsidian afraid. I feel that fear now from Sephi. She has never walked this path. No stained may stay among the people of the spires or the other tribes. All are chosen by the golds for service. Her mother would never have let her take the tests. She needed one daughter to remain as her heir. Unlike Olympus, Asgard is surrounded by defensive measures. Electronic high-pitched frequency emitters that would make the griffin's eardrums bleed 2 clicks out. A high-charged pulse shield closer in that would hyper-oscillate the molecular structure of any man or creature by boiling the water in our skin and organs. Black magic to the obsidian. But the sensors are dead today. Compliments of Quicksilver and his hackers. And the cameras and drones that monitor our approach are blind to us, showing instead the footage recorded 3 years before. Just as with the satellites. There is only one way to seek an audience with the gods, and that is along the Way of Stains, through the Shadowmouth Temple. We sat down atop the forbidding mountain peak beneath Asgard, where the Way of Stains is tethered to the earth. A black temple squats over the stairs like a possessive old crone, its skin ravaged by time, face crumbling to the wind. I'm pulled off the saddle and fall to the ice, legs asleep after the long journey. The Valkyrie wait for me to rise with Mustang's help. "I think it's time," she says. I nod, and let the Valkyrie push us after Sephi toward the Black Temple. Wind pours through the mouths of 333 stone faces that scream out from the temple's front facade, imprisoned beneath the black rock, wild eyes desperate for release. We enter under the black arch. Snow rolls across the floor. "Sephi," I say. The woman turns slowly back to look at me. She's not cleaned her brother's blood from her hair. May I speak to you? Alone. The Valkyrie wait for their quiet leader to nod before pulling Mustang and Holiday back. Seffi walks farther into the temple. I follow as best I can in my chains, to a small courtyard open to the sky. I shiver at the cold. Seffi watches me there, in the weird violet light, waiting patiently for me to speak. It's the first time it's occurred to me that she's as curious of me as I am of her. And it also fills me with confidence. Those small dark eyes are inquisitive. They see the cracks in things. In men, in armor, in lies. Mustang was right about Alia. She would never listen. I suspected it before we entered her throne room, but I had to give it my best. And even if she had listened, Mustang would never trust Alia Snowsparrow to lead the Obsidian in our war. I would have gained an ally and lost another. But Seffi... Seffi is the last hope I have. Where do they go? I ask her now. Have you ever wondered? The men and women your clan gives to the gods. I don't think you believe what they tell you. That they are lifted up as warriors. That they are given untold riches in service of the immortals. I wait for her to reply. Of course she does not. If I can't sway her here, then we're as good as dead. But Mustang thinks, as do I, that we have a chance with her. More than we ever did with Alia, at least. If you believed in the gods, you would not have sworn yourself to silence when Ragnar ascended. Others cheered, but you wept. Because you know, don't you? I step closer to the woman. She's just above my own height. More muscular than Victra. Her pale face is nearly the same shade as her hair. You feel the dark truth in your heart. All who leave the ice become slaves. Her brow furrows. I try not to lose my momentum. Your brother was Stained, a son of the Spires. He was a titan, and he ascended to serve the gods, but was treated no better than a prized dog. They made him fight in pits, Seffi. They wagered on his life. Your brother, the one who taught you the names of the ice and wind, who's the greatest son of the Spires in his generation, was another man's property. She looks up at the sky, where the stars blink through the black-violet twilight. How many nights has she looked up and wondered what had become of her big brother? How many lies has she told herself, so she can sleep at night? Now to know the horrors he suffered, it makes all those times she looked at the stars so much worse. Your mother was the one who sold him. I say, seizing the opportunity. She sold your sisters, brothers, your father. Everyone who has ever left has gone to slavery. Like my people. You know what the prophets your brother sent said. I was a slave, but I have risen against my masters. Your brother rose with me. Ragnar returned here to bring you with us. To bring your people out of bondage. And he died for it. For you. Do you trust him enough to believe his last words? Do you love him enough? She looks back to me, the whites of her eyes red with an anger that seems to have been long dormant, as if she's known of her mother's duplicity for years. I wonder what she's heard. Listening for 2.5 decades. I wonder even if her mother has told her the truth. Seffi is to be queen. Perhaps that is the rite of passage, passing down the knowledge of their true condition. Perhaps Sephi even listened to our audience with Alia. Something in the way she watches me makes me believe this. Sephi, if you deliver me to the Golds, their reign continues, and your brother will have sacrificed himself for nothing. If the world is as you like it, then do nothing. But if it is broken, if it is unjust, take a chance. Let me show you the secrets your mother has kept from you. Let me show you how mortal your gods are. Let me help you honor your brother. She stares at the snow as it drifts across the floor, lost in thought. Then, with a measured nod, she pulls an iron key from her riding cloak and steps toward me. The stairs of the Way of Stains are frigid and gusty, and switch back devilishly into the sky through the clouds. But they are just stairs. We climb them without chains, in the guise of Valkyrie, bone riding masks painted blue, riding cloaks, and boots too big for my feet. All loaned to us by three women who stayed behind to guard the griffin at the base of the temple. Sephi leads us, eight other Valkyrie coming behind. My legs shake from exertion by the time we reach the top and see the black glass complex of the Golds that crests the floating mountain. There are eight towers in all, each belonging to one of the gods. They surround the central building, a dark glass pyramid, like wheel spokes, connected by thin bridges 20 meters above the uneven snowy ground. Between us and the gold complex is a second temple, in the shape of a giant screaming face, this one as large as Castle Mars. In front of the temple lies a little square park, at the center of which stands a gnarled black tree. Flames smolder along its branches. White blossoms perch amidst the flames, untouched by the fire. The Valkyrie whisper to each other, fearing the magic at work. Sephi carefully plucks a blossom from the tree. The flames scorch the edges of her leather gloves, but she comes away with a small white flower the shape of a teardrop. When touched, it expands and darkens to the color of blood, before wilting and turning to ash. I've never seen anything like it, nor do I particularly give a piss about the showmanship. It's too cold for that. A bloody red footprint blossoms in the snow in front of us. Sephi and her Valkyrie stay deathly still, arms outstretched with fingers crooked in a gesture of defense against evil spirits. It's just blood hidden in the stone, Mustang says. It's not real. Still, the Valkyrie are overawed when more footprints begin to appear on the ground, leading us toward the god's mouth. They look to each other in fear. Even Sephi goes to her knees when we reach the stairs at the base of the temple's mouth. We mimic her, pressing our noses to the stone as the throat opens, and out waddles a withered old man, beard white, eyes violet and milky with age.
"You are mad," he howls. "Mad as crows to travel the stairs on the eve of winter."
His staff thumps each individual step in his descent, voice squeezing the lines for all they're worth.
"Bone and frozen blood is all that should remain. Have you come to request a trial of the stains?"
"No," I rumble in my best Nagal. To take the trial of the stains now would do nothing for us. We would only see the gods when we received the facial tattoos. And surviving a test of the stained is something even Ragnar thought I was not prepared for. There's only one other way to bring the gods to me. Bait.
"No?"
the violet says, confused.
"We come to seek an audience with the gods."
At any moment, one of the Valkyrie could give us up. All it would take is a word. The tension works its way through my shoulders. Only thing that keeps me sane is knowing Mustang's on board enough with the plan to be bent on a knee beside me at the top of this damn mountain. That has to mean I'm not totally insane. At least I hope.
So you are mad, the Violet says, growing bored of us. The gods come and go, to the abyss, to the sea down below, but they give no audience to mortal men. For what is time to creatures such as them? Only the stained are worth their love. Only the stained can bear the fever of their sight. Only the children of ice and darkest night.
Well, this is bloody damn annoying.
A ship of iron and star has fallen from the abyss, I say. It came with a tail of fire, then struck among the peaks near the Valkyrie spires, burning across the sky like blood. A ship? The Violet asks, now utterly interested, as we supposed he would be. One of iron and star, I say.
How do you know it was no vision?
The Violet asks cleverly.
We touched the iron with our own hands.
The Violet is silent, mind sprinting to and fro behind those manic eyes. I'm wagering he knows that their communication systems are down, that his masters will be eager to hear of a fallen ship. The last sight he might have seen was my speech before Quicksilver shut everything down. Now this lowly Violet, this eager actor, banished to the wastes to perform a mummer's farce for barbaric simpletons, as news his masters don't. He has a prize, and his eyes, when he realizes this, narrow greedily. Now is his time to seize initiative and gain favor in the eyes of the masters. How sad, the dependability of greed to make men fools.
Have you evidence?
He asks eagerly.
Any man may say he has seen a ship of the gods fall.
Hesitating, fearful of the deception I work, but disdainful of priests,